Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Mark Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremedyisinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look at these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedom's Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air, as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedom's Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, so winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make, if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedies in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, I thank you so very, very much for that disclaimer and sharing with us all that good information. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you have a pen and paper ready or maybe pencil and paper. I want to share with you some scripture real quick, and you're going to understand why this call tonight on law is being founded in the scriptures. So let's look for Book of Matthew, chapter 5. Verse 21 through 26. Matthew 5, 21 through 26. Book of Zephaniah, chapter 3, verses 1 through 5. That's Zephaniah, chapter 3, verse 1 through 5. The book of Psalms, chapter 103, verse 6. The book of John, chapter 5, verse 30. Book of Romans, chapter 2, verse 2. What are all these about? Well, go back to Matthew chapter 5, verse 25. Our Redeemer kinsman, the Messiah, Yahushua, whom you most call the Christ Jesus. He said, settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you're still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the bailiff, and you may be thrown into prison. That's what the Almighty One is telling you to do. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to another John, Information Provider John. Go ahead, buddy.
Thank you very much for that kind and gracious introduction, my honored brother. as Michael so carefully pointed out, there's some encouragement from many, many years back to when there's a disagreement to try to settle and sort it out before it goes too far, or in this case, before the magistrate. Now, the basic premise of human psychology is that ignorance breeds contempt, contempt breeds fear, and fear sometimes breeds a horrible, horrible, sometimes level of animosity and a negative response that some consider akin to the feelings of betrayal. But the fear of the unknown can cause things to escalate to the point where many people have stated that perception is reality. And I've been in court when a gentleman walking in with a package that inside the box was a bouquet of, a baker's dozen of bouquet of roses, but he was walking inside the, somebody perceived that the gentleman was possibly bringing a weapon in the box, and he was nothing more than a delivery boy. But what happened was is that perception caused a situation where a security guard ran over and screamed assailant and tackled the gentleman. And they, some innocent bystanders, came to the aid of this security person who the young man that was on the ground was his second year of college, and this is the way he's working away at the college, was delivering roses. He was there on a college scholarship for the football team. And when he was attacked, rolled over and threw the guard off. And a bunch of others jumped on top of him, started standing on his arms and his legs and beating him to a pulp to the point where he later died at the hospital. The family had all of all three security guards involved and charged with they tried to charge them with wrongful death. And the one police officer that came in before it was done, instead of peeling everybody off, took his baton and struck the young gentleman twice in the head. And the coroner later identified that those two blows were the fatal blows. And the officer was not even given time off. But and it came out that about 2.5 minutes later, this gentleman's girlfriend come running in, and she says to the security guard, says, my boyfriend came in here to deliver some roses, you know, and he points over to a crowd, and she went, is that your boyfriend? And he says, he was doing what? He says, he's got a bundle of roses delivered. They walk over, and she screamed, collapsed, and she didn't regain consciousness till after she was transported. All of a sudden, they realized that they had made a horrible, horrible mistake. But the thing was is that the ignorance that they had no idea what was in the box, somebody that breeded a little bit of contempt, and that little bit of contempt in that security guard's mind bred some fear. And the way he responded was he was going to alleviate what he feared, quote unquote, the surmised threat in his mind. And in the court case, the attorney that was there for the family of the young man, he pointed out that a misperception on their part did never constituted wrongdoing on that young college student's part, but nonetheless he was dead. And so what happens is that a lot of times when your adversary has a problem or a question about, well, he backed up into my garbage cans and damaged them, and it's cost me $25, so I'm suing this guy. In the meantime, this person is waiting for court. And the plaintiff in small claims court that replaced the two garbage cans and wanted the fees plus the court fees. They ended up not saying a thing till they got into court. And the plaintiff says, this man with malice intent damaged my garbage cans. And the defendant later pointed out that his shoe, he had stepped on a nail, and he went to step on the brake when he was backing up, and the nail had pushed up through his foot, and he flinched. And with the owner inside the house seeing what happened, thought that it was an intentional. Because you saw him slow down, almost stop, and then the car appeared to gun and damaged the garbage cans. And gosh, principal demanded that this guy be taken to task about it. And Nonetheless, eventually they got it figured out. The other gentleman paid for the garbage cans, but that didn't change the fact that they actually spent 3 separate days in court sorting that out. After the judge gave the time, the gentleman says, look, if that really happened, then your shoe has a hole in it. Bring me that shoe, you know, and where the nail was. And they waited all day the next day in court while another case was heard, and they didn't get heard, so it was the following day. But they were there the whole day, okay? There is a list of stories like that that we could share that come to the point where it's very, very encouraging for an individual that when you have a difficulty, find your opponent and chat with them. Try to sort out the difficulties. And the one thing that's very, very important is that when you have a worthy opponent pursuing you, especially if it's something like a bank or the IRS or a mortgage company or, you know, or law enforcement, it's very important that you get with them as early as possible. For nothing else, well, excuse me, for the first thing, that they see what your intentions and your character is really like. Oh, is there a problem? What do I need to do to rectify it? And that attitude has an almost heart-stopping shock, let the vow stem out of their excitement kind of effect in 8 out of 10 cases. And you'll be shocked at how all of a sudden when somebody says, well, you know, you hit my dog, you know, and I just, you know, you didn't even slow down. And when you explain that, yeah, that you're absolutely correct. I'm sorry, I couldn't slow down. I had a glass chandelier, I had a crystal chandelier in the back seat, sitting on a box, and if I would have slammed on the brakes, I would have shattered it. And what's worse is that my wife was in the right seat, and the glass shards could have injured or killed her. You know, and so, but you know, so if you go and talk to them in advance and explain potential mitigating circumstances with an attitude of, I'm sorry, there's something wrong here. What can we do to make it right? It's amazing sometimes if you can get the person's emotions to turn around that early. There's a case where many, many, many years ago, someone in Bishop, California got some fan mail from Provo, Utah. And the moment I said Provo, Utah, most of you know who I'm already talking about. It's the Treasury Department, the IRS office there. And about $58,700 worth of income that she did not declare. What happened was that they found out there were 5 individuals that were part of an investment group that that was offshore, and there had been some dividends paid and or benefits, and they didn't the quote unquote wasn't reported on any of the 5 individuals, and this young lady was one of the 5. And 4 of the individuals, the other individuals, did not respond right away. What we did was I actually wrote a letter for her asking, well, gosh, we're in receipt of this letter on such and such a date, stating an overage of $58,600 with an estimated tax liability of 20 with penalties and interest that is like 26 or 28,000. You know, it was a lot. And I says, are you referring to the money that was lost when this venture collapsed, and that there was, and that the $58,600 was part of, that was included in the original $70,000 that was sent down there when that bank collapsed and went out of business and everything was lost. And I asked her, I says, you know, if this is or isn't the case, could you please provide a complete accounting of this, you know, with certification and affidavits? Well, she got a letter less than a week later saying, yeah, we looked into this, we're sorry. Apologize, this is legitimate justification for what transpired. And yes, we agree you're not required to report this. Two of the other four ended up doing short jail time. I later found out many years later, I didn't know that there was originally five individuals involved in it. I wouldn't find out till after all four of the others were prosecuted. Two of them paid the penalties. They didn't even think about it. They never talked to them. They never tried to explain what happened until they were served not just with an audit, but they were served with a grand jury indictment, because back then that much money was already over the felony. Each one of them, it was already over the felony limit. And so they were charged with they had grand jury indictments, they're charged them with felonies. There's individuals that, I actually had the dubious honor and privilege of being down at the courthouse today. one of the cases, was something that, that I was personally related to. I went and looked into it, and it hadn't gone to trial yet, but I went and talked with, actually I had a chance to chat with the judge himself, and I talked with the judge's clerk, and we communicated, and, in the midst of that, he saw what was in my folder, my legal folder, and says, are those also? I says, yeah, I'm looking into those, and he says, well, I'll tell you what, you're in a wheelchair, it's going to be hard to get around. Let me do that for you. He went and ran around, and he says, you know this person? He says, he lives on my property. He lives as family to me. He says, so we could consider that you have power of attorney. Do you have power of attorney to speak to him? I says, I can get that to you, you know, within the next 30 to 45 minutes if you need it. He says, no, that's good. And we ended up talking, and that wasn't due to even come up for arraignment for 52 days. And we talked, and I ended up all the matters that I had, because we came in early, the judge was so, on one of them, was so taken that I had a she on one and he on the other two. I had a gavel on two and a gown on one. That the gown was so taken that she could have assigned a fine. And she says, I'm just going to summarily dismiss this for you, young man. And you tell that person to watch your P's and Q's. She was so kind, but she had a mouth like a garbage disposal. She was using four-letter colorful metaphors and French words, some that I haven't personally heard for many years, she had a mouth like a garbage disposal, but she was that's so effing sweet, shaving cream just make you want to smile, you know, and she used terms like that. It was really shocking, when I got home, and I left this morning before 6 o'clock. It was about 5:25 when I had left. And when I got home at 2, all the matters were completely adjudicated and dismissed. But we went down there and talked to them in advance. There's a gentleman who's currently got a challenge with the Treasury Department. He's gotten multiple fan mails for 3 years, separate years. And what we're doing is that we're asking, and in fact, right up until the time that we started on this call, I was working on one of the letters for one of those years, and we're asking them for the breakdown. But we're taking, they say the best defense is a good offense. We're taking steps to verify all of the facts before we get into it, and we're doing it in a very, very nice way. The last time I took that, somebody was already getting this much fan mail that I started putting in these letters. And the thing is that it's kind of a nuisance because they went 5 years back on this, and they're sending fan mail officially on 3, but not on 2. But so it leaves the other 2 years also suspect. So we're doing it all on all 5. But the last time I had something like this, we asked all these things in advance, and they got a notice from the prosecutor that there was going to be a grand jury hearing on their case. I prepared a nice letter. It was almost 8 pages long. Like, it was almost like a court pleading. And I think that may have been one of the things that got the prosecutor's attention. But I referenced all the footwork that we had done in advance, including something called a 6203. It's a document that under 26 U.S.C. 6203. It's a very short statute, and it just says method of assessment. The assessment shall be made according to by recording the liability of the taxpayer in the office of the secretary in accordance with the rules and regulations prescribed by the secretary. Period. Here's the biggie. So everybody listening. Upon request of the taxpayer, the secretary shall furnish the taxpayer a copy of the record of assessment. Okay. They, of all the times that we've used this, over half of them, they never make those assessments. They never send them out. And only one of those times, out of all the times, all of them that they didn't make the assessment, we got the complete debt dismissed and the case dismissed with prejudice because they never responded to the taxpayer. And so we tried to settle with them in advance, and they didn't. And luckily the judge, and this was a gavel, he says, look, I can't expect you guys to respond to something like this when they didn't do any response to you. So he said, on my own motion, I'm going to summarily dismiss this. Both prosecutors objected vehemently. They were ready to hang this couple out to dry. And the judge, he very sternly says, look, your client, the U.S. government, the Treasury Department, who, as they already pointed out, is just servants of the people and their employees, did not do their job. Please sit down. And he was very firm with that. And the lady, she says, there was a man and a woman prosecutor there. The lady, she got really upset. And the judge says, I'm sorry, but I'm about to find you in contempt. You should probably leave now because the case is over. Before the case is completely over and you get to stay. And she said, but, and he held up his gavel to slam it. And she cleared up her briefcase, put her laptop in it, folded everything up. Couldn't even get the briefcase closed. And she carried everything out, and the bailiff helped her carry everything out. But she couldn't leave fast enough. Okay. But the fact that the couple that we had worked with them, they had already an inkling that they were in trouble because they got a letter for 1 year, and they ended up getting letters for 5 years eventually. By the time when we got the notice, or when they got informed that there was going to be a grand jury hearing and that they were going to be allowed to submit, or they were demanded to, they were actually served with a subpoena for records for the grand jury hearing is what I, that's how they found out. But what happened was that when we wrote that letter, the prosecutor realized that, you know, hey, this, you know, these people have tried and tried and tried to comply. And she said, and she called him up personally. She got a hold of the wife. She was on home at the time. Says, at this time, the U.S. government is dismissing the case against you and your husband. And she was very kind about it. She treated the lady with the highest of dignity and respect. And it was amazing, you know, that that she was treated that way. And so the thing that's really important is that every time the prosecutor has, in a vacuum, I'm going to deal with the times that right now that there was no response. That they're dealing with no response. They end up seething under their breath. And I've had multiple prosecutors that are friends, personal friends, that one of them, we were working on some election fraud for the Michigan, state of Michigan for the 2020 elections. And she commented that, that burns me up when these people know they've done wrong, and you know they don't try to work or anything. So I shove it to them, you know. And I says, what about the ones that, you know, one moment you indicated that there's a problem, they come and talk to you. It says, well, those are different. She says, if that happens, I'll try to work with them. She says, some of them now, and she says, remember, I'm not everybody. There's some people in my office that it didn't make a difference who they are. Once it's come up for prosecution, you know, the ball game, they're avid sports fans, and they are very adversely competitive, and they play to win. I says, play to win? She goes, yes, John. They consider it a game, and they take it egotistically personal when they don't win. And when somebody gets one up on them, they try to double down on them and come back. And the more they lose, the harder they lose, the more they come back and they try to, you know, even if it's calling in favors from the judge, personal. I says, that's not legal. And she says, I didn't say it was or wasn't legal. She says, but see, two of the prosecutors in my office went to school with two of the state district court judges in Detroit, and she says, and that mayor over there, she and the U.S. district court judge and our state attorney general Janice all went to school together, and she said they graduated the same year. She says, how are you going to get around those type of relationships, personal friendships that transcend anything that long before you ever came along? She says, it's just not possible. You know, you have to figure out how to deal with the situation before it gets escalated to that level. And while she said that to me, and I was just dead shocked. I says, this literally, as what Michael was saying about Matthew 5:25, when he bought up, it says, settle the matters quickly. The adversary is taking you to court. Do it well. You're still with him on the way, or he may hand you over to the judge. The judge may hand you over to the bailiff or the officer, and you may be thrown in prison. And I tell you the truth, you will not get out until you've paid every last penny. You know, and so in the last 4 years or 5 years, I've been bought in on a handful of students' situations that pre-existed my knowledge of their situation. And the thing is that by the time it gets to the fact that it's in a prosecutor's hands, it's very serious. And they, the way they get promoted is by how many cases they successfully prosecute. That's one of the primary indicators that they may be doing their job, because first of all, not just the fact that they won the case says they did their job to their employer, which means that when they come up for their annual evaluation or their quarterly evaluation, you know, that they've got cases that are won. It means they're doing their research, they're getting the facts and evidence to promote that. And that means they're doing some legwork, and they may actually not be sitting next to the water cooler sucking on a lemonade cooler. They may actually be out there doing some work, which is kind of scary, you know, when you see different justices and running for office, and they say, there have been successfully 309 convictions during my last term of office. It's like, holy broken tree feathers, Batman. We're priding ourselves on the convictions. What about, there's 309 cases that we've seen proper justice in, meaning that the innocent went free also. And you see, when you hear a candidate for those type of offices make statements like that, or an attorney general, that under me, this many cases have been prosecuted and individuals are in jail, that begins to, you know, strike a note where you begin to scratch your head. And for me, you may scratch your head, but for me, it worries me, because they're not saying that 319 cases saw justice. It's there were 319 convictions, and that I have met the individuals, and one of them, she and I were at law together at USC in the 70s, and we had two classes together in a four-year time frame, but she is ferociously adversarially competitive, and when it comes to a case, she doesn't care if the person's innocent or not. And I had to point out that she ignored exculpatory evidence in one case, and she threatened me personally, and she said, "You tell anybody and I will wring your neck." And I believe she wasn't kidding, you know. And I says, you know, please, that's really unbecoming of a prosecutor. And if that was actually what you just said recorded, because the thing in my pocket has been going off on its own. And, she says, "What do you mean?" "Oh, sometimes my phone, you know, it's designed to record all the incoming calls, but sometimes the recorder doesn't shut off." And she looked at me so stark, and I says, "I didn't say that it was, I didn't tell her it was," but she, at the time, I pointed out, you know, and I pulled it out, and I pressed the stop button a couple times. I says, "Watch this." And I flipped it open, and I called a friend, and I says, you know, and then I closed it, and I put it in my pocket, you know, and I says, "No, I just called him up to see." I told him, I "don't have time tomorrow to see you. What time do you have available?" And he says, 4:00. I says, "You know what, I still may be able to make that work." And I said, "Bye." I put it in my pocket. I pulled it out, unfolded it, you know, and I said, "So what do you think of that?" And then I stopped it and I played it, and it played the end and it played, "What do you think of that?" And she looked at me so shocked, and I says, because I was so mortified that she was actually that way. And when at the time of that question, I hadn't seen her for probably 10 or 12 years. And, I says, "You know, it might be good to change the tactics on that." She was asking for help in slamming these three gentlemen, you know, and she reminded me. She says, "Your mother said that if you were a prosecutor, there'd be nobody walking the streets, and if you were a defense attorney, there'd be nobody in jail." And she says, "Right now, I need your help on this one." You know, and she was, and she's a prosecutor. She's now retired. I think she realized after I shared some things with her about the potential liability that could follow up after her. And I told her, not, you know, and I have no intention of making anybody else aware of what you've done. but it might be wise for you to retire at your earliest convenience to a non-extradition country. And she says, you're serious? I says, Kelly, you have no idea how scared I am for you right now. The things you shared that you've been doing, the fact that you so glibly shared it with me means that you are a glib person, and this is not an uncharacteristic conversation, and you're even proud of it. That means you've shared it with other people. And what happens if one of them just gets upset with you and decides to tattle and talk outside of class? Says you'll be the one that'll be getting some new clothes from some free new clothing, orange, you know, free food, jail food, you know, free jewelry, bracelets, and extended vacation at Club Fed. You know, and she looked at me and she said, you're serious? I said, you can't. She says, you can't be. And I said, please. I remember when we were in school. I remember one time in one of the classes, you sat only one row across from me. And I really liked the way you responded to the professor. That meant a lot to me. You made some very constructive things, you know, and I learned from you. And I'm still learning from you. But I think it's wise. Well, the last time I heard her, she had retired. And none of the phone numbers that I had for her, and none of them that the prosecutor's office has for her, work. And her children don't know where she's, or won't say where she's living. And her husband, he packed up wherever they did and went together. But the thing is that talking, she realized some problems and things that were problematic, and she changed her tune. There are so many times, there are 2 out of 3 prosecutors will, at least 1 out of every 2, but sometimes 2 out of every 3 prosecutors will, if they realize that this is dead wrong, they will stop. They will dismiss. There's that 30%+ that sometimes their ego will write checks that their butt can't cash, and no matter what happens, they're going to seek a conviction. And among that was 2 years ago in the state of Cincinnati, in Cleveland, Ohio, we ran into a situation where the judge got so offended by somebody did something dead wrong. He lied. Something actually that when I was telling you about the Form 26 U.S.C. 6203, that request, he lied about 7 years of that on behalf of the defendant and put that in pleadings and threatened the defendant to file them. And the defendant ended up in not just in court, but in jail. We just got him out. I've been working on a compassionate release for almost a year for that one, but he's out right now. But right now we're working on getting his conviction overturned. And I've got some help with that, and there's somebody else that's taking point because he wants to learn how to do it. So I haven't been having to spend that much time with him. But had we been able to talk with the folks, the prosecutors that were involved in advance, I believe one of the prosecutors might have listened and realized that it was all a mistake. And the thing is that we had, I now have affidavits that state that all the monies that they were talking about were loans that had been previously made to them that they were paying back, and that it was not income, but that the person at the bank in this little town, thought it was mishandled money. I have one similar, almost identical case in Nebraska. We haven't really started on his, but it was somebody that I was bought into very, very late in it. And I realized, and it hit me like a brick when this person's about to get out, because when I was talking with the prosecutor about a year after he was convicted, I had quite accidental, didn't know it was the same prosecutor, was on a conference call, was talking about it, and I was bringing up exculpatory evidence in assistance with another student that I had long before I met Michael, and I was bringing it up, and I said, you know, there's a couple of people in this state that have had a similar thing, and this prosecutor asked, well, like what, like who, and I explained that I had affidavits. These people were paying back this gentleman who, when he had his farm was working good and he sold off the extra land, they this little town in Nebraska, the people were in trouble. He loaned out over $500,000. And she says, tell me who that is now. And I gave the name. And she says, I prosecuted that case. I says, that guy was dead wrong. I says, what do you mean you've got affidavits? I says, I've got affidavits right now that these people were paying that gentleman back. No, 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 that was unlawful funds. You know, this is, we've still got some other corrupt, you know, other charges to levy against that guy. I says, would you like copies of these? And she says, you're darn tootin'. Well, she was using a little vernacular. But had I had a chance to bring these up to her in advance, she is the one that's currently is precipitating his release. If we had talked in advance and sorted things out, he would have never had an extended vacation at Club Fed. It's very important that sort out what the complaint of the other party is. Regardless of what you think the complaint is, remember, perceptions aren't actually reality. You know, and one person, he was saying, look, you know, you're doing this and this is bad. I says, and right before the judge, I says, a misperception on your part does not constitute wrongdoing on my part or this other person's part. And the judge says, well, I'll be the judge of that. I says, Your Honor, if I perceive you to be a mortal threat for me right now, and I have a firearm, so you're saying that I can alleviate that perceived threat? And she says, OGN, you know, oh, God, no. And I says, thank you for making my point so poignantly. So perception is not reality. She says, I says, you don't have a gun pointed at me underneath your bench right now, do you? And she says, the guns aren't allowed in the courthouse. I says, yes, they are. You know, and I asked her, I says, where in the Constitution exclude the right to keep bear a firearm in this courtroom? And I says, so knowing the law, it's my perception that you could underneath your bench. And she held both hands up. She says, see, I don't have anything in my hands. I says, thank you, ma'am. But, Your Honor, I think, but we did make the point, didn't we? And she says, yes, you're right. And at that juncture, that case turned around right there. But at one point, I need to confess. At one point, the bailiff walked up and was standing right behind me with his gun drawn, pointed right between my shoulder blades. He was about to put his hand on my shoulder. And he hadn't pushed the gun into my shoulder blade, so I didn't know it was there. But I was sitting in the wheelchair. I didn't realize it, with a gun in my back. And so misperception, you know, the best way to alleviate misperceptions is through good communication. Good communication happens best when it occurs before egos escalate or the ignorance escalates into contempt, and definitely before the contempt escalates into fear, and definitely, most definitely, before the fear escalates into action or response, okay? So, which individuals, some people, some prosecutors, says, well, I'm going to take this route, and so-and-so that's robbing from the people, you know, and IRS code 7203, 26 U.S.C. 7203, says any person liable. And I've quoted that on two or three conference calls already in the last two or four or 6 months. And much to my shame and your chagrin, I'll just quite you know, keep quoting it just, without shamelessly quoting it, you know, without any humble reservation, so that you get to know those codes like the back of your hand, okay? And, so 6203 and 7203, very important. The 6203 is asking for the assessment, and this is part of the advanced communication. And the 7203 is, who is liable for paying the income tax. Very, very important that, I've already had multiple cases over the years on the 7203, and if you use LexisNexis, or, actually, that requires subscription. Cornell Law also has the function where they highlight the word person, any person liable. The first three words, very, very important. On the 7203, the person has a underscore underneath it, a light one. And if you click on that, then it's it's extremely cool. It clicks over to 7343, which is the definition of the term person. And that's the title of that section. And this is a one-liner. It says, the term person shall be used in this chapter to include officer, employee of a corporation, or member, employee of partnership, whose such officer, employee, or a member is under the duty to perform an act with respect for which the violation occurs. Oh, is that right? Only corporations are required to, well, that's why, you know, the cussing and the discussing about all caps and the fact that that is a corporation, identification of corporation in your name in all caps, and that many judiciary, many gowns and gavels recognize that instantaneously. And however subtle it is, if you fail to correct that right there and have your name in upper and lowercase, you know, capital J, lowercase OE, SEPH, uppercase D, lowercase OE, you know, if you fail to correct that, they catch that. They know that. And I think it's very important when you're working with, Michael and GW about correcting your status that, these things get taken care of in advance, and so that you're no longer technically part of a corporation that could be liable for the income tax. Okay. So, that all has to happen in advance. They say an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. An ounce of prevention in this case, you know, correcting your status, or if you have property issues, taken care of well in advance, as in Corp Souls or Charitable Religious Trust, you know, working with Justice Brashears, and any of you who are concerned about your preparations for property. And remember one thing, if you put it in a Corp Soul, it's in Corp Soul, you can leave that for perpetuity. I'll ask you this question in closing. How many of you know what the acid test of ownership is? You've heard that term before. How many of you can say, I absolutely know what the acid test of ownership is? And if you don't know, I'd like to share that with you. And here it is. If you either bought it with you when you came to this rock, or you can take it with you when you leave, then you the girl, or you the man, or you the guy, or you the woman, you know, you the owner. But if you didn't bring it with you when you come to this rock, or you can't take it with you when you leave, then it kind of begs the question, well, who does it belong to? And is that the guy with the sheep and the cattle on 1,000 hills and all the gold and silver therein? Which also begs the question, why are we attempting to cling to it? And for some of us who have less shopping days in front of us than we do behind us, for those of us who are over 23, and, you know, yeah, it was murder term 23. I don't know what I'm going to do when I hit 26. But for some of us, we have a few less shopping days in front of us. And to that end, it becomes clearer and clearer that ownership sometimes is not just, negative option, but it's a stumbling block and an unnecessary entanglement. And especially when it comes to passing on something to your heirs, or the fact that somebody did a bump and rob or bump and run, and they're suing you now to take what you own, because you've decided to cling to it with your, or I've decided to cling to it with my dirty, greasy, grummy mitts. Now it gets taken away. And the thing that was temporarily in my hands that I thought I owned now is double no own. Not just that for eternity, but now for, in this life. So, ask yourself on a regular basis the asset test of ownership and ask yourself, is that an asset or a liability for me holding onto that? And should I have that in an entity that will transcend my presence on this rock? With that, if you,
Michael, his name is Michael.
Yeah. With that, if you have, not quite yet. Down boy.
Okay.
If you have, other questions, that's fine. The subject matter just, for the evening, if you have questions related to subject matter, that's good. But your questions are not limited to the subject matter of the evening's topic. Thank you very much. With that, now I turn it over to Michael.
Thank you, John. I want to take another stab at your question as to ownership.
Okay.
The Almighty went aside for just a moment in the world. Ownership is determined by your taxing authority. In other words, if you own land and you can have someone on that land and charge them tax, you can do that because you own the land. Which brings us into the question, when we buy a piece of property and we pay, I'm just going to say, $200,000 for the home and the land that it's on, and we own it outright, why are we paying somebody else property tax?
That's a good point. That's a good question. Would you like an answer?
Oh, yes, I would.
Oh, shucks, Ma. Okay. The way English feudal law, Scottish feudal law, and actually Spanish, all the way, you know, most of the sources of all the people groups that came to America, actually over 80% of the people groups that came to America came from or through Europe. And the property owner in those cases was always the highest taxing authority, and the government didn't have the authority to tax unless it owned the crown, in those cases, owned the land. That's why landowners were so so important. And, you know, and it's kind of funny. Many, many years ago, I saw a movie called Braveheart with Mel Gibson, but they talked about the landowners, you know, and how critical they were. And some of you may have seen an old movie called Robin Hood with Errol Flynn. And the guards are beating up this guy, and this woman comes in, this elderly woman, says, "You can't do this to him. He's a landowner." You know, and it's very, very critical. So what happens is that much of that carried to the United States, especially in the discussions of land grants. And in the land grants, most of them, there's only been one that I've seen that hadn't iterated the fact that the property owner is the highest taxing authority for that jurisdiction. So, Michael's question about why are we paying taxes to somebody else, that's because we haven't completed our responsibility at either perfecting the title in Allodium, and that's a very simple process. I say very simple. It's very simple to define, but hard to do. It's just bringing the title, showing the etymology and the chain of title from the original land grant to present, and here's where the penny drops, that at no time in any of the conveyances was the right of taxation conveyed to someone else or some other jurisdiction. Okay, that's the title in Lodium. Then there's another one that I don't think Michael will mind me speaking about that we've been working on for a while, that under the premises of the Declaration of Independence, paragraph 2, that we believe all men are created equal and they're endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights. So among these are the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And among those, and it's saying that this comes from a much larger pool of rights, indicates the right to own property. And if we have a right to own property, then if you can levy a tax on something to the point where if that tax is not paid, and this is the acid test of a right, that if that tax is not paid, then can you take the right away? So is that an inalienable right, or is the tax being inappropriately applied? And so what's happening right now is that I've been working on a brief and a supporting documentation so that we can take an individual with this documentation and have them removed from the tax rolls on this alone without the having to deal with allodial title or title in allodium. There's places here in Texas where the title only went through three or four or five hands in 200 years or 100 and some odd years. That's not the case in certain places, especially if it's in one of the original 13 colonies. Sometimes titles, there's 40 or 50 conveyances of title, which makes it almost a nebulous, almost semi-unattainable process to confirm the title in allodium, meaning back to the original land grant. So we're working on another approach right now. I just haven't had the time or the finances to finish that. Right now, it's probably going to cost me about between $250,000 and $375,000 to finish the research and pay all the fees and everything else that I need to do and some of the stuff that I need for legal help to finish that brief, which one person in L.A., Greg, that I was we went to school together from elementary school, and we were at law together in the 70s. After I got out of the Air Force, Greg was just graduating as I was starting law, and he just sold his practice a year ago, December. And but Greg commented that he says, John, he says, you know, I may just for kicks and grins fund you on your pursuit because I charge $250,000 or more than $250,000 as a retainer for suits of that matter that don't get the takeaway when you get done with yours. And he says, just for kicks and grins, he says, I may have you do that for me. And he says, I says, and you'll pay me your regular rate? He goes, yeah, he says, I might have to. But so does that help, Mr. Edwards?
Yes, sir, it does. Thank you. That's what I wanted everyone to hear. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. Press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand, and then I will unmute your phone, and you may speak directly with John, comment, or a question. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, you'll see in the center right of your monitor the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. It's empty inside. Left-click inside. Type away your comment or your question. Underneath that rectangle, you'll see a place to put your name, other information if you like and if you will, and then hit submit. Then it will pop up on my end, and I will be glad to give voice to your comment or your question. So with that having been said, we'll start with Kent. Then after Kent, we have Anita as so far at this time. So we start with Kent. Go ahead, Kent.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hey, Kent, before you take off on where you're going, what were your thoughts on the call that I did earlier tonight?
Oh, I thought you started out well. I apologize for the delay, and the other speaker ran over time.
Oh, okay.
Unfortunately,
I got across the board.
Well, unfortunately, I got cut off during the call, and after you had to take that other call for a moment, your voice became distorted, and it was hard to hear you and make out what you were saying. So I really can't comment. I thought you started out well, but, you know, partway through, I lost you, so.
All right. Well, maybe we generated enough interest to get some contact out of it. Go ahead. I didn't mean to sidetrack you. Go ahead, Kent.
So you were able to finish the call in, even though I didn't
hear you.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Very good. Very good. I was thinking, actually, I think that the two speakers for one evening was probably too much because apparently the other gentleman had some questions there and wanted to continue to talk. And I really think that you need more time to properly lay out.
We both did, probably.
Yeah, the vast array. So I think I would contact the gentleman that ran that and ask him if you couldn't come back another time. I mean, assuming there was interest by the audience. That's what how I would handle it. I was going to call you and talk to you about it.
I'll leave that in your hands. You can be my promoter as I promote John.
Okay, very good. So, John, on a prior call, since you were on last week, I don't know if it was Wednesday night or Saturday night, a question came up. Michael was talking about the traffic stop case either in Arizona or New Mexico where the gentleman had his car searched, was ultimately arrested, faces a bunch of charges, et cetera. And Michael was saying that you were ready to file. And when I asked this question, I'm not asking you to give away any strategy, so if it's inappropriate to answer it at this time, then we'll wait till after it's done. But he was talking about how you were raising the Title 42 1983 issue, and that, of course, is civil in nature. And he was first mentioning that criminal charges were being filed. So I pointed out that this was civil and not criminal, and I didn't see how this was being turned into a Title 18 criminal charge. And it was agreed that you were the one that you knew something about this, and you were the one to comment on it. Now, I asked that question from the point of view that most of us don't consider ourselves to be private attorney generals. Most of us don't believe that there's a common law court in place where we could take this, let alone provide any enforcement. And I don't know how much we could do other with their bonds or their insurance policies with a civil matter. So where could this go from a criminal point of view? And then I have one or two other comments or questions that I would like to address.
That's a very good question, Kent. I'm glad you asked. In that particular case, I'm preparing a submission for a grand jury indictment that is a true bill that would be given by the individual, the injured party, to the prosecutor with the letter explaining the issues regarding the prosecutor's responsibility. And the prosecutor's signature. Now, something that most people don't even have a clue about is that on the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, the issue there is that Title 28, under 28 U.S.C. 2072, the U.S. Supreme Court was assigned by Congress the authority to prescribe the rules of criminal procedure and the rules of criminal evidence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in these cases. Now, the thing is, and that's 28 U.S.C. 2072, and that's a good one to remember. And 2073 is the rules of evidence, et cetera, and 2074 is the rules of evidence that were submitted to Congress. Okay, the thing that's very, very important is that that most people don't realize is that when it defines the indictment, it talks about the that the prosecutor must sign that. And so what's happening is that we're getting to a place where we're realizing that the prosecutor technically doesn't have to agree with the indictment. They're just performing content. And that's the direction that we're trying to get to, because what happens is that right now, the grand jury indictment, they require that the it's signed by the prosecutor, okay? And so what happens is that when we come to the grand jury indictment, it's if you have a grand jury indictment, say, against a judge, do you think a prosecutor would go sign a grand jury indictment against a judge when they have to appear in that court every single day and do live and work, and this is their bread and butter and their employment?
Nope.
You know that you've heard that saying, don't defecate where you eat.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. Supreme Court carefully worded that so that at that juncture, that would prevent or at least dissuade any potential prosecutor from making out anything against that judge, because it's literally almost a you'll never work in this town again. What's happening is that now we're working on the, as part of the submission for grand jury indictment, I'm working with two federal prosecutors in Michigan, one in Virginia, one in California, and one in Arizona right now. We're working together to sort out how to best word this so that they do not feel that it's going to compromise their ability to make a livelihood, that and we're coming to the place where I'm hoping this coming week we'll have that response. I was hoping to have it this week, but we haven't got that yet. And so what's happening is that filing grand jury indictments against for deprivation of civil rights under color of law under 18 U.S.C. 242, the officer or the arresting officer and the prosecutor and the or arresting officers, etc. What happens is that, and then the prosecutor under 18 U.S.C. 241 to go get the grand jury indictment. In one of the cases and one of the charges in this is a felony unlawful carry of a firearm, okay, etc. But what happens is that the conspiracy to and then go with the grand jury and then with the judge to get the judge to issue a warrant for this gentleman's arrest is the big issue. And so what happens is that if we, right now, we're working on a disclaimer that the prosecutor for the signature block, that will allow us prosecutor to be free from potential hazards, so that they so they'll feel comfortable with signing it without us having to go to the point where we say, hey, look, the prosecutor's under grand jury, you know, or guilt. We don't want to really make the prosecutor guilty of the grand jury, something that we need to get the grand jury involved in. So what happens is that if we, there's any way to keep them on our side, we absolutely want to keep them on our side. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So in other words, what you're saying, John, and correct me if I'm wrong, this requires finesse, and there's no rule out there anywhere within the federal Title 28 or anywhere else for that matter that basically states that if you bring this indictment, grand jury indictment, that they have to sign it, even if the form and content is correct. They have the discretion not to sign it. Now, you have other things, as you're describing, that could be done, but they still have the discretion not to sign it. Is that correct to that point?
That is the present school of thought. We are working at bringing up, in an academic manner, a point that will be part of the signing that's submitted by the citizen so that they'll feel comfortable with signing it and not realizing that they're, there's going to be a disclaimer on it that they understand that everyone reading this understands that the prosecutor's signature herein is required under Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, Rule 6B12, that is only confirming form and content, not manner, and not the pleadings. That in no way, shape, or form does the prosecutor agree or disagree. Can the signature be construed to indicate the prosecutor agrees or disagrees with any of the aforementioned complaint filed by a citizen?
Okay.
That's part of the wording that we're actually looking at right now.
Well, that sounds like a plausible venture or a plausible approach to handle that. What I raised in the original question about a private attorney general, such as things that Rod Glass might have done, just to use one example, good, bad, or indifferent, do you see any efficacy in that, or do you think this is too early on, based upon public opinion, et cetera, to take that approach?
You know, you say private prosecutor.
No,
I've heard that term.
Private attorney general is the term that I've heard most frequently.
Okay, I have not heard that term yet used.
Maybe private prosecutor. Maybe we could substitute private prosecutor for the purpose of this question.
Well, the because I haven't actually now I haven't heard private attorney general used for many years. And the best as I can remember, there was something called the Private Attorney General Act of 1866, but that was primarily a California statute that allowed some unique prosecution, and I don't remember all the details with that. And I think it was something to do with employer-employee relations, and that there were some extensions into the union world on that. But other than that, I can't speak to that right now.
Okay. Let me go on to my second question. I noticed that during your response here, you cited Section 241 and Section 242 of Title 18. Now, if one has corrected their status, I assume or conclude that you shouldn't actually be quoting something from their statute. So when you quote that, I just want this to be clear in my mind and other people's minds. Are you quoting that from a point of view as it applies to them and their own statutes apply to them, and making a clear distinction that you're not quoting law that does not apply to. Now, I'm not saying that it's still not a deprivation of rights, but I'm wondering why it should be quoted as such when the man or woman has corrected their status.
Excuse me, Mr. Park Ranger. You've looked at my documentation in your computer here, but and you know who I am, that I'm a Wyoming national and an American national, that I find a sleep or in a place I repose in Wyoming. Are you under the laws that govern your employment under 18 U.S.C. 242 committing a felony in the second degree that I'm compelled to report?
Mm-hmm.
Do you see the point?
No, I see the point. That's what I'm saying. So you're using it from the point of view that it's their law that applies to them, not from the point of view that the man or woman who corrected their status is citing that law. I just wanted that to be clear. That's all.
You know, yeah, maybe, you've hired Annie's housekeeping to clean your house, and the three people come in as usual. Wait a minute. Aren't you breaking your rules of employment? Doesn't it say that all the garbage must be put into a bag before it is put into the garbage? You can't not deposit it directly. And do I need to notify your employer and have you have that addressed by them? See the
mm-hmm.
issue?
Right. I got the point. Okay. And thirdly, and did you want to add something else, sir?
No.
Okay.
If you've got
thirdly, in the past, I don't recall whether it was last week or the week before, you talked about some of your, well, you didn't really talk about, but you mentioned your experience in the 1990s in having cases go to court for the correction of status, but at that point in time, you were unable to get it through the courts, was my understanding of what you were saying for the most part. But now you believe that this administrative method used by GW certainly does the job, so to speak. So could you elaborate just a little bit on what problems you faced when you say, well, I couldn't get these through court, but now we can do it administratively?
Well, you may need to listen to the recording from last week, because we were getting issues through the court back then, but some of them were revolving around the following. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We didn't have a data information system that the moment you got your passport card, in fact, passport cards didn't even exist back then, and that even driver's license didn't have mag stripes on them back then, that can carry the data that they do now. And I say can do now, that they've quit putting all the data in the mag stripe on the back of your card. The only thing they put on the back of your passport card or your driver's license or et cetera is the CPU EISN or the DRE EISN, the data recognition identifies serial number for your account. That's all that's on there now. But what happens is that now, with the computers that we have, the fact that your status has been corrected, is something that's available on the computer. And if you did the same day correction so that it was immediate update, I want to say in September 16th, I may have been in a State Department office, in a State Department archive, where a deputy regional director pointed out that when my personal status request, my affidavit initio was looked at, she pointed out, she found it. It was still 28 months in the backlog. But the fact that we had done a same-day people who've done the same day passport, by law, amongst many of the other things that must occur, is that if you have something submitted like that, it must be updated in your account that day. It's an unbelievably tremendous workload. They're trying to figure out a way to get around having to do that. But until they do, I think it's wonderful that by the time at 2 o'clock in the afternoon you get your passport card, that all that's been updated. Other things include the fact that if you're abroad off U.S. soil and your passport becomes mutilated or stolen or unusable, the State Department has 24 hours from the time, from the minute and second that you notify them, to provide you with a replacement suitable document, okay? And it says suitable document, which means that it can also include the letter from the State Department or the President to be able to move about freely, travel or return to the U.S. But at this juncture, without the proliferation of the information systems that we have now, we had to take time to educate every judiciary, and we had to bring certified evidence with us that is now available in their computer, and they can look it up, and they don't have to worry about certifying it because it's on their system. And so, and they can look it up in minutes and seconds, the stuff that sometimes used to take 3 to 5 days worth of court hearings. So it was, the term a challenge didn't even begin to apply. The process, is it the same? Yeah. Anything, any big difference between what we were doing back then and what GW is doing now? Almost not a drop. But the information capacity has made a big difference, and that's the issue.
So what you're saying is whether or not you took it through the judicial process in the 1990s to correct your status, or whether you did it the way GW is doing it for the last 10 or 15 years, basically it's the same. There isn't much of a drop of a difference, so to speak, between those two methods. It's just one was done judicially, one is done administratively, but the fact of the matter is the information systems are much more updated now, so it goes that much faster. Is that a good synopsis?
Okay. With a small correction, we only used the judicial when we could not get the administrative to work. Could you please stand up and get out of your duff, get your fanny perpendicular, and quit loafing around by the water cooler, Mr. or Mrs. State Department agent, when they would not do it, or they were too lazy, or hold on, we've got other duties, we don't have to deal with that. Then we had to do a judicial file with them to get a court order to get it done.
Okay. I appreciate that information. Thank you. I think I took enough time, so I won't add any additional questions. Thank you very much for your responses. Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome, Kent. It's our honor and privilege to serve you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Request lines are open.
Most
back action. To you, Michael.
Thank you. Most excellent conversation. Anita, you're next.
Oh, hi, everyone. I have.
Hey there, young lady. How you doing tonight?
I think the emphasis is on lady and young, I think. Two emphasis.
Sick 'em dog.
Anyway.
You go, girl.
So I have two questions, I think, here. So since you know, I'm working on, my house was foreclosed because of property taxes not being paid. So since I have my deed going all the way, well, it's not complete, but I have tons of original deeds and the original land grant and maps and a million things. And since my deed, when I bought the house, and I owned it outright with no mortgage, nothing. So that it said on there that it was a part of the original patent, and it's listed, you know, everything. And then when you go back, it always says that, the deed before that, the deed before that. So why would you need every little bit in there? Because how could it have been brought forward to me if there was any time it went somewhere else? Like to the government or
That is a wonderful question. That is a fabulous question. I would love to answer that for you. You ready?
Yep.
Okay. Sometimes in those deeds, things like easements or appurtenances were granted, meaning that there's a well on this friend's property that and there's a water line that connects that to this other building over here, but now the property has been subdivided. Before I can sell this property to that person, I need to make sure that they're not going to go dig up that pipe and cut it. So to that end, I'm going to make an easement for that belongs to this property and any others that it might be subdivided into. So what happens is that some of the rights of that property have now been subjugated to something or someone else, another entity. And to that end, when we were doing the original titles in Lodium in the Grimes County and Austin County here in Texas, we found out that individuals to promote commerce and civic buildup and to support the finances indicated that they, as part of the deed, the taxing authority would be this specific entity that they were creating to receive those taxes. And so once you've done that, and anybody along the title has done something like that in a title, in a deed, now the school taxes, property taxes, those transit taxes, all those are now unavoidable.
I think
just
I
like,
follow
just
that.
Like but... you, just like you can't dig up the water pipe, you know, and cut it off. You cannot stop the taxes now. That's something that, and also there's things called deed restrictions. And I remember when this started to become popular in the 70s, in the state of Texas, they were exclusively for the purpose of preserving and encouraging residential property. But I knew people, godly men, that would buy up whole blocks or whole sections of property and then deed restrict them against any kind of business that could sell pornography or alcohol. And this one gentleman, he was very, very serious about alcohol. His father, his grandfather, and his great-grandfather were all alcoholics and died of alcoholism. And the term used as a punching bag didn't begin to apply. He still had deformation on his left cheek of where his father one punch cold cocked him one time and broke his cheekbone, and he spent 9 weeks in the hospital barely clinging to life because his father was drunk when it happened. His father died before he could be prosecuted for cirrhosis of the liver. So he kind of had a teeny bit of a grouch side on about alcohol. He was buying up whole land tracts and deed restricting them against use of pornography or alcohol sales. Now, on the flip side of things, I know oil companies that later capitalized on that by buying up all the property on all four corners at many, many intersections, indeed restricting three of them against anything that could sell petroleum distillate products. And then they own the fourth. So that's a way that you can encumber a note or a deed, and we have to verify that the encumbrances do not include taxation. Does that make sense, Anita?
It does. So it could be back there somewhere, even though it doesn't come up on your deed. I mean,
deed references the previous deed, and that deed references the deed previous to it. Very good.
Yeah.
That's the abstract.
Yeah, and then there's the then yes, and then the you know, it says it's free, and I mean it says it's free of all encumbrances. It's free of what? It says all those things. So that could just be BS.
Say that again. You were breaking up.
Well, it's a, you're saying that it could have restrictions, but my deed and the title company and everything said there were none.
Yeah. Yes, that's very, very important. Deed restrictions are different than assigning taxing authority or giving it up to some other. That's, and I'll be honest with you, until we were doing the original portion of the Stephen F. Austin land grant, I never knew that such a thing could exist. And it was mm-hmm. after that. So that's when I realized, you know, that that was a serious entanglement, and that there were individuals that had copies of the original documents that were that had those assignments of taxation authority in them, and they were very quietly, and I found out the one place where this was really prominent was in Southern California. It when there was times when they were forming LA City and LA County, etc., the City of the Angels, they large tracts of land were encumbered with the responsibility of taxation to the city and the state.
Okay, so, well, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask if you were still there. You were kind of quiet there, young lady.
No, usually that means I fell asleep, but this time I didn't. So when I bought it, and, you know, I thought it didn't have anything like that, but I didn't know that that could exist. And, you know, it says it's mine, my heirs and assigns forever, and basically no one can do anything. And then it came up for, I owed taxes, so it went through the first process of, I think it went to the city or county. But then my mortgage company paid the back taxes, so it never went through a full, it never got sold. So it came back to me, and the new deed, suddenly my heirs and assigns forever, but it said, except for, you know, 10 years later, now they said if there was a lien for taxes, then it wasn't mine forever. So something happened. Who knows what they did? But they did something, so they changed the deed to say that there could be a lien for any kind of taxes, and then, you know, it's not yours forever.
Yeah. And like you said, I'm not certain what they did, but I think, and one of your documents that I have that you'd forwarded to me, I think I did read something about that. I need to go back over that. I apologize.
Okay.
Right now my workload is kind of a little heavy with a couple of some students that some things have come up. Today there was a hearing with one student that somebody filed some very illegal things, but it looks like there's some relationship with the judge. Got something that shouldn't, there's no way it should have been approved. I've got probably a week to 2 weeks worth of work on that alone, so there's a few priorities ahead of you right now. So I'll beg your grace if we can catch up with this probably in a couple of weeks. Is that okay?
Yes, but can I ask a second question?
That'll be a nickel. We accept Visa MasterCard.
Yes. Okay.
No American Express.
No,
we don't accept American Express.
Can I sell it to you? That's more modern. Okay.
Hit me, girl.
So assume that I have all these deeds, and there is nothing that we can find where authority was given to someone else, taxation authority. Assume that's completed. What is done next other than I just go down there and say, you know, pay me some money because you stole my property? I mean, what happens? I mean, is there some easy administrative process where we just say
it's going to take a judicial process. It's going to require a judicial process to be successful, meaning that not one of these individuals with the New York assessor collector's office or anybody is going to, on their own, they are not going to put their liability on the line, their own word on saying, yes, you're right, we were wrong, and then have themselves get fired by somebody between them and the governor for doing so. They, not one of them in their right mind would extend out their risk by making a statement like that. So what's going to happen is that we're going to have a judicial response that that clearly states, hey, look, I reviewed this lady's case, and it's the opinion of this court that you never did have the original right to take this, and we're requiring you, in because she objected at the time, and this is why when you object to something or you sign a traffic ticket, non-assumption or whatever, or you say property taxes paid under protest, this is why when you say that it preserves your right, because you say we objected, that she objected at the time and paid only under protest, or the property, even under protest, you still took it. You should have listened and gone farther and done your due diligence, because you didn't. And it is lawfully hers. You must restore her. And to that end, I'm requiring you either to restore the property to her or the equivalent of the monetary value now defined as such and such. And a judge will put that on there.
Okay, but I knew nothing about objecting at the time officially by saying paid under protest.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
We'll
talk about it later.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, let's.
We'll talk later.
We'll catch up on that one later. Okay.
All
take
right.
care, young lady. You behave yourself now, right?
I'll try.
You'll try? Talk about not stealing confidence in the customer here. What's this try stuff? Hey, I once knew a young lady that was so well behaved, we called her misbehaved.
That's almost funny. Okay. Thank you.
Mm. If you weren't that young, it would be funny, wouldn't it?
Yes.
All right. Let's see if we have anybody else on Freedoms Radio. Let's see what's going on there. Anyone else, press star 2 on your keypad. Otherwise, we're going to say goodnight. Kent, welcome back.
There's something that you just said to Anita when you made the analogy between the water line having an easement and serving several properties before it was subdivided, and the analogy to if there was something in a prior deed or document as to the taxes that you may never be able to get rid of those taxes. I didn't quite understand that, and I didn't get the analogy there.
The analogy was there was an encumbrance on that deed that you own that either says there's a responsibility to never damage that water line, and that you can't build on that property that blocked the potential maintenance of that water line because it's an easement. And that's the encumbrance. And the encumbrance also is that the fact that they're giving up the taxing authority to a third party or somebody else or an entity is also an encumbrance. that once it's encumbered like that, the only way to get it back is to go beg, borrow, or trade, or horse trade, or buy, purchase it back.
So that would not be corrected then, if I understand you correctly, that would not be corrected by an allodium or title in allodium and a land patent where you would then overcome that? You're still saying you would have to.
Oh, no. Yeah. You're absolutely correct, Kent. Because title in allodium, see, what happens is that your title in allodium, you're just establishing it at what it was originally defined to, and you're verifying. Now, part of allodium is verifying all the encumbrances, if any, that have been placed on that property. And if there's a deed easement for a water line or for taxes, those are all encumbrances, and that title is still confirmed in allodium, but there's nothing you can do now about that. Now, that is a contract. And if you have a contract that says, I agree to pay this tax or give up, and their remedies are to take the property, then that would abrogate the other approach that we've been working on about cases where there has never been an encumbrance on the property by any of the predecessors from the original land grant. And in my particular case, there are four predecessors to the grant for the property that I currently own. And some people in California, I've seen in excess of 100 on 103 on one property. That was really, and I never could have believed it existed. But nowhere in the first 30 some odd deeds that we went through was there any encumbrances at all. It was like, I think it was 42 or 46 on that particular property that we went through that we found the encumbrance that gave the city of Los Angeles the right to collect, or a county to collect taxes.
But if that encumbrance came at the time in the beginning with the land patent, I could see your point. But if the encumbrance, which most likely I would think would have happened sometime down the line in the chain of title, why, if you're clearing that title and going all the way back to the land patent and title in the allodium, wouldn't that problem then be solved?
Now, you mean resolved?
Resolved, okay. Yeah, resolved.
Okay. That's a good question, Kent. Whoever conveyed the title, the original title, the original land grant with the authorities and privileges, they had the right to withhold whoever, whatever, how much ever, you know, and they had the right to say, you know, you've got this property, except that you can't, no giraffes over the height of 12 feet can ever walk or cross it. They're prohibited. You know, and forever after, you can't bring a giraffe across that property. And now, when they convey it to you, the title in allodium is very simple. You have the authority to, quote-unquote, do and make those all these different transactions. And just like the original person that conveyed it here to this country, in those cases, it was either a lord or possibly the king. And many of the land grants, the Spanish land grants that were in Mexico and portions of old California, were granted by the king of Spain and signed by the king of Spain, literally, with the wax and sealed with the wax seal. And I had the honor and privilege in 1979 seeing one of those original Spanish land grants open. Now they did it with a movie camera rolling, but they opened the wax seal to confirm that, you know, the claim that the individuals had on, and that they were claiming against the state of California. But see, now you have the authority to sell off whatever you want to. And you can sell it for a penny or you can give it. Or you sell it for a dollar. But see, that's for perpetuity. The fact that you sold for a dollar the right to have that water line in the back. If you want it back, you can't just have it voided. You have to buy it back.
Well, how would we, so let me ask you this. I mean, from a reasonable, practical, everyday point of view, why would a taxing authority want to let you? I mean, I'd have to think this out a little further as to what you might do to induce them to agree with you. But why would a taxing authority want to be bought out? I mean, they now would believe that even
they
if you
wouldn't.
The title.
They absolutely wouldn't. And
right. In a land patent that, you know, that they can collect taxes in perpetuity. So they wouldn't agree with Anita in allowing this to be changed.
You are so correct. And to date, I have – now, hold on. Now, that's not completely true because in Arizona, I actually did witness a taxing authority in a little town in the middle of Arizona allow somebody for $250,000 to buy back their taxing authority. And it was for a ranch that never really amounted to much, never produced much, but there was a cattle ranch. And, the little entity needed, the little town, and the county needed some funds very, very badly at that time. And the fact that this individual knew that and offered them exactly what they needed. And, the board of supervisors was, incredibly, incredibly open to it, because one of them had mismanaged a little bit of funds. And, this was, may have not executed their due diligence. Let's use that term. On how they handle something, and this was saving their bacon. So this gentleman and his wife and his mother, they had it down cold. What they were doing, and they both, oh, holy broken tree feathers, Batman! They got it. Now that was, oh gosh, 37 years ago. And at the time, we were helping a lot of other people make the same propositions. But of all the ones that we proposed, in the little teensy weensy microcosm of experience that I might have, that was the only one that was successful ever.
Well, so then just for clarification, what Anita is asking, and however her deed might have got changed, you were saying you don't know, you have to research that further over time. I don't know who else would have the power to change that deed based on the facts that she gave us on the call here. But she would then be well advised, I would think, to make sure that this situation does not get out of hand or go to some kind of sale or tax certificate wherein it might be difficult to get it back or there'll be some outrageous amount of interest attached, whatever, and make it, you know, practically impossible to get the property back. Because what you're saying is that it is possible that whether she knew it or not, when she did stop paying the taxes, she may not be able to buy her way out of this depending on what the encumbrance in the prior deeds are. Is that basically correct?
Okay, you're kind of correct, except that on one point, Anita had already lost the property to property taxes, the one that we're talking about.
Oh. Okay.
And so what happens is that the fact that it was already lost to property taxes indicates, and that the jurisdiction that foreclosed, that's already, quote-unquote, a done deal. So what we need to do is come up with a legal reason why they couldn't do what they did. We have to prove that what they did was wrong. We have to prove that they did not do their due diligence when they executed the lien sale and sold her property and took it. And we have to prove that they did have a legitimate responsibility to protect this widow's interest, okay? And so to that end, you know, understanding all of the aforementioned, to that end, there's a few things we'll have to prove to get Anita's property rescued there. But that doesn't mean it can't be rescued. It just means there's a few things we need to do. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, it does. I unfortunately, I was asking you questions only having a little bit of information, so I obviously don't know as much about this case as you do. So,
well, hey, it's always okay to ask questions, right?
Right. Now, I do want to make a comment about what your program was about tonight, was about going to your adversary and settling with them. And I want to make a comment about tax assessors, because I see this on a regular basis. People don't like the amount of property taxes they're paying. I'm not going to argue whether they should pay taxes or not, but they don't like the amount they're paying. So they run off, and right away they want to file a tax appeal. And I can tell you from my experience that that's not the way to do it. The way to do it is go talk to the tax assessor. Very often they won't be comfortable, as you were talking about, in doing something for a certain reason because they're afraid it's going to come back on them. So you give them the option. You talk to them nicely and businesslike and professional, and you ask them. They always have other people that they're working for, working with, and that they're looking for, you know, possibly a way to justify what you're asking them to do. So you ask them, you know, say, well, how about if I agree to meet with your tax attorney for the municipality or the city? How about if I agree to meet with your the one who does your commercial assessments, et cetera, if it's commercial property? And you can very often settle things that way without taking it through appeals, where it becomes very adversarial, and then the egos get involved and everybody wants to save face, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, just the piece,
right.
Because I see some people run off to tax assessors, run off to,
yeah,
you know, trying to do a formal appeal. So.
Yeah. Now, yeah, completely understood. I agree with you 100%. I have a meeting set up for, it's still 5 weeks away, but, on a tax, property tax issue here in the Houston area, that literally, we're going to be doing exactly what you just described. So, yeah. I'll just be frank with you. We've already gone past the issue that, they even tried to foreclose on this person's property already. And, what happened was is that, I like to deal with everything. I like to use what I call the clean hands policy, meaning that, there's nothing in arrears or illegal on your part right now or in controversy that they could go to a judge and say, hey, look, we don't want to talk to this guy. They're behind or they're doing this or they're not doing that. So what happens is that, if we eliminate or remediate the controversy before anything else happens, then chances are better that we'll win or have a receptive response, that we'll win a response from the people and that they'll talk to us and consider what we're proposing. So, yeah, you're you're spot on, Ken.
Okay, very good. I have some other comments I could make, but I think I'll hold them for the time being. It deals with deeds and contracts and so forth.
Well, thank you very much for your input, my honored brother.
Thank you. Thank you for your program.
Take care.
All right. I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. John, do you have any closing comments you want to make before we go?
Though a man seeks an audience with the king, it's from the Father in heaven that he gets justice. Always remember that no matter what or who we're going to, whether it's this taxing authority or that taxing authority or this lieutenant governor or that judge, always remember that there's one that they are responsible to, and that's the Most High King. And And I'm going to tell you something, and I hope I'm not talking outside of class on this one, Michael, but Michael and I have had the honor and privilege of just in the last day or two, situations where individuals said, look, it's toast, there's no hope, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Already talked to the judge. And the judge says, all in, all done, all the oxygen free, 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 there's nothing else you can do. And we stopped and asked the Father for some grace. And literally, while Michael and I were on the call, we could hear somebody in the background calling this gentleman's name. Turns out it was the judge's bailiff. And we had just got done praying and just got done asking the Father's help for this gentleman because he had completely given up. And all of a sudden, everything was now had a whole new face, a whole new light. And the Father granted grace for that gentleman while we were, while we were talking on the phone. So never forget to talk to your Father in heaven about your problems. It's a he lets a lot of this occur so that you'll have a good reason to talk to him. Talk to him. Don't waste your time talking with me and other people unless you, have already talked to your Father in heaven. Night.
All right, John, 1 second. Jennifer, Sue just raised her hand. Let's hear what she's closing with.
Hi, John. About the red light ticket, I called the number, and there's no way we can get anything done on the phone. We have to do it online.
Jennifer, I never said anything. I never said that. Here's what I did say. I call up and I ask them, how do we file? What's the procedure? I just ask them what the procedures are and who has knowledge of the procedures. And so when we get to the person that has knowledge of the procedures, that's usually the person that has the administrative issues. And when I ask the questions about, seeking having the witness list and everything else, where would we get those? And when they realize the person that has the capacity to answer the question about where it is, not weigh the facts, they just administratively have been deleting them.
I see.
That's okay. So
are you available at 9 a.m. tomorrow to try and do that?
I have a conference call. Michael, let's see if we can bump the California folks to 9:30, and we'll take Jennifer at 9.
Okay. Jennifer, I need you to call me 5 minutes of 9, okay?
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
All right. I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. It's been a great call. Please tell your friends. And encourage them. Feel free to give them the phone number and the PIN. Share with them American by Birth or correctmystatus.com. Share with them Bernie's The Ultimate in Asset Protection.com. And also remind everybody tomorrow night we will there have Mr. Slevin, and we'll talk about this LLC that is a complete game changer for everyone, particularly people who call themselves employees. So until then, till tomorrow night, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you.